Hello, dear friends. It is I, Duncan Trussell, the Skrillex of podcasting, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell
Family Hour Podcast.
And now, a quick word from our sponsors.
In 2006, I told you what you should be afraid of. In 2009. In 2010, I told you what you should be afraid of. In 2012. Both of my predictions were terrifyingly accurate. And now I'm back to announce my new book, Finch Holloway's Be Fear Now. Go to BeFearNow.com and know what to be afraid of this year, next year, and the year after. You should be afraid of being afraid of the wrong thing. That can kill you. Be afraid of the right thing. Order Be Fear Now and know what you should be terrified of today, tomorrow, and forever. BeFearNow.com.
Order in the next 5 minutes and receive 3 bonus fears at no additional charge. All right, today's guest has a brand new podcast located at mindpodnetwork.com. There are, I think, 3 episodes up by now, one with Pete Holmes, one with Natasha Leggero, and the one that I'm currently releasing. He's also the author of some wonderful books, including A Path with Heart, A Guide Through the Perils and Promise of Spiritual Life, The Path of Insight Meditation, Seeking the Heart of Wisdom, The Path of Insight Meditation, and as many of you know, he trained as a Buddhist monk in Thailand and has been teaching meditation ever since. He's an amazing human being. Everybody, please send as much love as you possibly can to the wonderful teacher, Jack Kornfield.
All right.
Cool.
Well, so I do need it as we start, Duncan. So you're going to do some introduction? I am. What's the deal?
Well, that's the cool thing about this, yeah. Which is that we don't quite understand what this is yet. This is, we did a podcast at a Ram Dass retreat in Hawaii, and then and that was one of the favorite podcasts I've ever done. And then Raghu Marcus and I have been chatting about the idea of getting spiritual leaders like yourself to start their own podcasts. And this hopefully is the beginning of you starting to do this on a regular basis. And so it's just an introduction. Podcasting is the easiest thing, really, on earth. It's
like boiling an egg, huh? You just turn it on and open your mouth, and all that stuff that you've been thinking about anyway starts to form as words, and people go, wow, that's interesting, or what a weird guy, or whatever, and then they feel like they're closer to you.
That's it.
And it helps them realize that we're all in the same human boat together.
That is it.
Sailing in uncharted seas. Yeah, yeah.
Very uncharted seas. And yeah. you already do this. I listen to you practically have a podcast already. The sum total of all your audiobooks and lectures that are available online, on Audible, all of this is, you basically have this. It's just that it doesn't have to just be lectures. It can be one-on-one with people, because that must be a huge part of what you do, is with your students. You must have these incredible moments with them, just having conversations with them.
We do have a lot of one-on-ones, especially when people come and they do a week or a period of meditation practice, and then I'll meet with them periodically and say what's happening, you know, and then we have a conversation, often a very heartfelt one. Well, I'm sitting here and I just heard that, you know, my sister has a breast cancer and I'm dealing with that, this person might say. Or they might say, all right, I'm sitting here, you know, and I have all these memories coming back from some bad stuff that came down with my ex. And I never really told her that I was sorry, that I, you know, I've got a lot of regret or guilt or whatever. And so we just talk about that. And, well, what do you do with that stuff? And we're all dealing with that kind of stuff. And in our own lives, we get very caught up in the busyness of our lives, which is fine. And then you stop, and it's almost like the unfinished business knocks on the door and says, hey, remember me? Could you spare a little time?
No. Come back later.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And when you do, sometimes it's painful, because a lot of times we don't do it because there's some grief or longing or something that we haven't wanted to feel or pushed away a little bit that actually needs our attention.
And that's what you're really good at. And that's when I started, after I met you, and then I started listening to Path with Heart, which I've been listening to again and again, and then doing the meditation, sitting and meditating. I said, oh, man, I got really good. I was doing it every day. I was really doing it, man. And then just like what you're saying, you're sort of orbiting around this thing way, way far away. And then you get closer and closer in. And then suddenly you realize everything that you're talking about is quite true. And you begin to experience this incredible pain. And then for me, it's like, well, we'll do this later in a few years or something.
Yeah, I'm too young to do this. I should go party first. But yeah. Then people have the other thought. I'm too old to do this. You know, older people. I should have started when I was young. That's called the doubting mind. And it comes in and says, I can't do this. I should go to the beach for a while and do a little boogie boarding. And then I'll feel better. And then maybe I can face myself.
Yes.
You know. But in fact, it's just the fact of being insecure and feeling like this is hard, which it is for almost everybody at certain points. And then you keep your seat, you don't get up, and you say, all right, this is what hard feels like. This is what not knowing what to do feels like. This is what wanting to go run away feels like. I know if I'm sitting at home and I'm having a hard period, one of the rules that I make for myself in meditation is that I don't get up unless I really, really want to, three times. So the first time I'm sitting there, you know, and I've been meditating and I've gotten calm and things are chill and it's great. And then I start to think about, oh my God, I've got a lot to do today. I better write this person. I've got to call this. I do this email. You know, I've got to get to it.
Yeah.
And I feel this huge wave of both energy to do stuff and underneath it, actually, anxiety, like, how am I going to get all this stuff done and so forth? I better get up. And I go, okay, anxious, desire, wanting to get things done. And I just name it. Okay, this is the mind that can't be where it is because it thinks that who I am has to do stuff all the time. And I just name it, you know. And I also feel the tension in it, which is hard to bear sometimes. And,
yes.
You know, and if I stay with it for a while, the tension, then it softens and dissolves, and then I'm just sitting there again, and sunlight streams through the window, a little slant in the morning, and, you know, I feel the coolness of the morning air, and I remember, oh, yeah, human being, halfway between heaven and earth, human incarnation, fine. Here's the breath. I can love everything in a very deep, peaceful place. And then ding, 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 the little alarm goes off, and it says, yeah, but you forgot to call Cheryl back yesterday. And she's going to be so upset with you because you were planning this whole thing, and how could she make the, you know, the reservations for this, and, you know, and all of a sudden, then along with that marches in, you know, like guilt and, you know, or some grief from something that I, oh, God, I never didn't apologize to her for what, or whatever, or something even deeper. And I go, oh, I need to get up and contact Cheryl. And then I feel that whole wave, you know, or the grief that comes.
The grief.
I should get up. The grief for things undone or unsaid or done. And or things lost. And I just name it grieving. And then I soften my heart a little bit and breathe grieving. And I feel I want to go away. I want to get up. All the resistance, resisting. And then as I allow space, it's like it's just making space. The image is, if you put a teaspoon of salt in a cup, it tastes very salty, the water. But if you put that same teaspoon of salt in a lake, the water still tastes pure and clear. And so make all this space, and there it is, resistance and grief and tears, and I just feel that, and it settles down. I go, oh, yeah, Now I'm even in a deeper place, a stiller place, because I can hold all that. Like at the center of everything, there's a stillness and a vastness and a silence that goes, okay, here we are, human life. Isn't this wild? And it's all right. It's completely fine. But I don't feel certain about it. I feel a little insecure. Oh, yeah. It is insecure, human life, isn't it? And then I can hear my teacher's voice in the background laughing and saying, yeah, he called it the wisdom of uncertainty. He said, you're uncertain. I'd say, yeah. And he'd say, that's really good because that's the way it is. And he'd laugh and he'd say, so just relax. Relax, he said, where it's all like we're going down the stream and you can trust it. It knows how to unfold and then you respond instead of being on alarm all the time. And I get quieter and quieter and then there's that line from the poet Pablo Neruda where he writes, you can pick all the flowers, but you can't stop the spring.
Mm.
And that beautiful line of trust and realize that even the things that are tough in the world, there's some life force underneath it that flows through me and everybody I know and pushes the weeds up through the cracks in the sidewalk and wants to renew itself. And I can take some more breaths and just be and rest.
But why are we wrestling with it? Why can't we just... What is this? Why is there a constant wrestling match happening between this force, which might be paradise or heaven or this constant wave of love or I don't know what it is, yet... I felt that. But then I'll realize, like, somehow I'm fighting against this. Like, I don't want that. I don't want the big lake. I want the salty cup. Why? What is that? Is that addiction? Am I addicted to this pain? Why is it that I'm the one who's pushing love back?
One language for it in Buddhist psychology, the small self is called the body of fear. It's really based on a kind of very primitive sense in our whole nervous system. We have to protect ourselves. And if we accept that things are uncertain, and if we allow ourselves to feel the grief and so forth, we also become vulnerable. And then we're like this thing, you're the Duncan single-celled organism, you know, that little protozoa, and you stick out a little pseudopod and sniff, is this good to eat? Or, ooh, this feels toxic. I better kind of swim the other way.
Yes.
So that's really built right into us,
yes.
the preservation. But there's a whole other dimension that knows that body of fear doesn't have to run the ship. It's right. Not who we really are. It's protected us. It's fine. It's good. But who we are is so much more spacious and free and untouched by the sorrows, even though they're so deep they feel like they go to the bottom of the earth. Mm. There's something bigger in the heart that says, wow, we're in this mystery, and isn't this a trip? Isn't this amazing? And there's a kind of purity in the soul of people, and it's a beautiful thing. So we can get caught in the small sense of self, in that fear, and that's just human, that's natural. And then you go, as the poet Hafez says from the Middle East, and I love quoting the poetry of Iraq and Iran, and you know, instead of going to bomb them, let's learn their poetry, right? And he says, fear is the cheapest room in the house. I'd like to see you in better living conditions. And so you realize, oh, yeah, you bow to it and say, this is the fearful mind, and this is the habitual or addicted quality to that fear. Ah, yes, and here we are, and isn't it? You know, let's try to see what the lake tastes like. Oh, the water's really pretty good. Maybe we could even swim.
You know, the problem with you doing a podcast is it makes people just want to be silent, because it's the thing you're pushing in the direction of is this beautiful expansiveness that's outside of language. So everything when I came in here to talk with you after just this amount of time now, it's just, well, what is there to say? It's beautiful what you're talking about. It's beautiful. And I thank you. That's what you do. You remind people of this thing because it's some form of amnesia. It's an amnesia that we have. And you're like some I don't know what you call your...
You were going to say psychotic, but
you're
you had the psych something. You've got
psychotic.
Some weird psych thing going on.
Do you categorize yourself as a... What do you categorize yourself as, or do you...
Um, my occupation is as a teacher, mm. as a meditation teacher, and as a, you know, I write, so I suppose I'm a writer. But I'm like everybody else. I'm just muddling through being a human being, trying to figure out how to be a human being with some integrity, because it feels better, not because you're supposed to.
Right.
And to see what's beautiful around, because that also feels better. And doesn't mean not seeing the other sides of things. But there's something, I think, you know, when you see little kids that are just born and toddling around and stuff, there's this child of the spirit, this kind of wonder that's born into us. And then we get busy and, you know, get in our roles and thing, and we forget that we're in this huge mystery. In Bali, they say the people closest to the gods are little kids and very old people who know they're going back, right? Mm. And the people furthest from the gods are middle-aged people with mortgages, basically.
Yes.
You know, where we forgotten. But in a moment, it can change. And there's a lovely passage from Guillaume Apollinaire, the French philosopher, where he says, "Now and then it's good to pause in our pursuit of happiness and just be happy."
That is awesome. That is so cool. Right. Right.
So it's not even pushing, you know, the end of words or stopping. It's just like, here we are, you know, and our mind goes off in 1,000 places. But actually, here we are. Look out the window. Feel your, you know, foot on the floor or the carpet. Look at the strange building that you're in, or the shapes of the trees as you're, you know, driving along. And anything. I mean, as Walt Whitman says, a mouse is miracle enough to stagger sextillions of infidels, you know? And you hold an avocado, you bite into a section of a tangerine, and there's nothing in a trillion galaxies that tastes like that bite of tangerine.
Right.
And it's fantastic. You go, human incarnation on planet Earth. Wow. Now what do I do with this? Isn't this amazing?
But this, you know, when you say that, and I know what you're saying, and I, you know, I just went up to Big Sur recently and was sitting on a cliff looking out over the ocean and thinking to myself.
And on what substance anyway? Keep going. Oh, yeah, that was really good. Uh-huh. Which is legal now. Keep going. Anyway.
If you're saying that I'm smoke pot all the time, you're 100% right. But I think, strangely, in this moment, I was not stoned, which is pretty weird.
Big Sur does it, too. You just sit out there on the edge of the cliffs in the ocean. You look all across the body of water that covers half the planet, and you taste the winds that dusted the tops of Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa and Hawaii and are now blowing those breezes into you, and you go, hey, man, this is something.
This is it. This is what I thought was, this is the paycheck. This is better than a paycheck. This is something bigger than what the world can give you or human society can give you. And so, but when I hear, you're so good at articulating that feeling, but what comes to mind, the fear body, the amoeba, thinks this is hedonism. This is a kind of Dionysian hedonism that you're talking about, and to live in that way, makes you want to abandon everything, get an airstream, find a field, and sit in the airstream and look out at the wind blowing.
Oh yeah, that sounds really great, doesn't it? But you know, we're social animals, and so that's only part of us. But also, we want to come into the city and hear an amazing, you know, musician and get dazzled by the, you know, the lights and have a meal from some culture we've never eaten before. And they eat this and taste that explode in your mouth, because we're also adventurers and we're explorers and all those things. And part of being present is just not to be so stuck in the roles and the small sense and the fears. And it doesn't matter. You can be a captain of industry and you can still be stuck. I have this cartoon from The New Yorker that shows two generals striding down the hall of the Pentagon. They've got all those bars and medals on them, you know, and so forth. And one says to the other, "It really shook me. I can tell you, I dreamed the meek inherited the earth." Right? And that, you know, you can get whatever role you're in.
Right.
You can still have that fear. Well, what do I do? Or this is who I think I am.
Right.
And who you are is spirit, is soul, is consciousness taking a ride in human incarnation and saying, wow, isn't this amazing? And then you say, well, what, you know, at the end, then what are the rules? Well, if you hurt yourself and hurt other people, you'll suffer a lot. So that's one rule.
Right.
If you, on the other hand, have compassion or respect or for non-harming yourself and others, you'll have a much easier and more beautiful ride. If you shut yourself down and shut yourself in, you'll suffer in certain ways. There'll be regrets and so forth. If you open yourself up and learn to surf, the waves are still coming, but you take the waves and you make art and you make music and you make love and you create, and you fall down and then you get up on the next wave, you know, or
right.
a few waves down, you brush yourself off and clean, get back up. Then you get the ride. And I mean, if you're going to Disneyland, you might as well take the ride.
Yeah. Yeah, you might as well take the ride. When did you start teaching? When did you realize what? Because you know, it's not just what you're. What's really cool about being around people like you, or being around people like Ram Dass, is that you are put. I don't know what it is, but you have. There's something, and I bet when you were around your teacher, there must have been some energy that he was radiating, or something that he's putting out. There's an, and maybe that's a placebo effect or something. And I just want that to be there. But to me, when I get around you, there seems like a tangible outflow of energy that is behind what you're saying. And you can say, I mean, someone could mimic you and parrot what you're saying, and it wouldn't have any effect. You know, it's like you're using words to get some kind of other energy out.
I love the placebo effect. People kind of poo-poo it, but really it's like that, the opening verse of the Dhammapada, which says that mind is the forerunner of all things. That the life we live, the chairs you're on, the electric lights, the cars on the street, the shape of the building, the words that we're speaking, the language we're using, all that was somebody's creative thought, and then they built it, or they designed it, or they whatever. So mind creates the kind of world we live in. And so to say, it's only the placebo, if it's like to saying, well, it's only mind. Yeah, dude, look at what mind can do. It can do anything.
Right.
So, of course.
But when did you were in the Peace Corps, right?
I was in the Peace Corps. I was studying at Dartmouth College. I was taking science classes and maybe going to go to medical school, doing pre-med stuff. And then I took this course on Asian studies and Buddhism from this old Chinese professor who'd come up from Harvard, who would sometimes sit cross-legged on the desk and talk about Lao Tzu and the Buddha and about suffering and freedom and compassion. And I needed it. My family was a mess, as a lot of people's family. It was pretty painful. My dad was violent, abusive, and paranoid and things like that on a lot of days. Not every day, but often. Nobody in college talked about that. They wanted me to read about, you know, medieval Spanish literature or get the good equations for biochemistry or something like that, all of which was very good. But I needed to learn about my own life, how to deal with the pain that I carried from my family, how to learn to love somebody else. I wanted to have a relationship, a girlfriend, a life, you know. I needed to learn also what my values were, because we were in the middle then, as we are now, of a country that's really confused. Mm. We make war all the time, and then we think we're the great peacemaker of the world. You know, we talk about sustaining the beautiful earth, and at the same time, we and our companies are part of that, which is, you know, ruining the climate and the environment. And we're in the middle of all these huge tensions. And I said, well, help me find a way to figure out what values to live by. And that was not part of the Ivy League curriculum. Mm. So I started to read Buddhist teachings. And I thought, oh, this makes sense. You could live with compassion. You could direct your life. You could train your heart and mind to live listening to a kind of inner understanding or love, you could find a gold Zen master. Maybe he would teach you.
Yeah.
So I said, oh, I want one of those cool Zen. I wonder if they still exist. I think I'll go in the Peace Corps. I could have gone in the, and would have otherwise gone to Vietnam in the Army.
Wow.
And I thought, well, I could go and I could shoot at people, you know, or I could maybe do something better. And I signed up for the Peace Corps and I said, send me to a Buddhist country. So it was going to be Thailand, back to Southeast Asia. And then I looked for a meditation master to study with. And I found one of those old Zen master type guys who was, like you said, he had a lot of humor and he radiated a kind of well-being. And he was the salt of the earth. He was funny and grounded and fearless in a lot of ways, and whatever you'd come to say to him, he'd seen it or heard. He'd say, yeah, yeah, there's that too in human incarnation, and what are you going to do with that? You know, are you going to tie yourselves in knots, or can you look around and make space and realize your heart can be free even though that happened to you?
Right.
And I go, oh, yeah, I feel that from him. So, and then I came back and people said, what happened to you? And I said, well, you know, I feel better. They said, well, how did you do that? I said, well, there are these great practices of compassion here. You know, forgiveness, you can actually practice this. And it's not like it happens right away. It's like practicing piano. You have to learn it a little bit.
Right.
It's like that letter the guy wrote to the IRS where he says, I've been unable to sleep for the past 2 years because I cheated on my 2011 taxes. So I've enclosed an anonymous cashier's check for $3,000. If I still can't sleep, I'll send the rest. You know,
yeah.
And we're like that. We do a little bit, and then, as you said, you know, we take stock, we backslide. But if you do it for a time, you realize loving people, what better thing is there to do? Being creative, you know. Yes, you're anxious or whatever. That's a fine thing. Do it anyway.
Right.
And then you realize that your spirit is free and that you can do that. But it helps to have support, inner support through calming and centering, through all these kind of meditative things that modern neuroscience says they really work.
Yes.
And also friends like Duncan Trussell that you can listen to who kind of remind you of your humanity. And as my friend Annie Lamott, another humorist, likes to say, my mind is like a bad neighborhood, I try not to go there alone. So you get to go there with Duncan instead, or something like
that's
that.
That's cool, man. Yeah. That right. You definitely. This is one of the many reasons you're a teacher is that you make it seem so appealing, and I get you feel the pull into it when I'm around you, and when I listen to you, definitely more so when I'm being in your presence is drawing me back into that, but it sure fades away, man. It sure fades away. I remember coming back from Hawaii, hanging out in Hawaii, getting to listen to you teach every day in Hawaii, getting back to LA. Dustin picked me up at the airport. He said I was glowing, seemed so happy. How long was it before I was screaming at you at my apartment when we were drunk, Dustin? 2 weeks. I'm screaming at him in my apartment.
Yeah.
2 weeks, and I'm like turned into a total troll.
There we are.
So 2 weeks, and I curdle.
And then what happened? Did you stay that way?
No.
Of course not. No, no, I mean, that's what's supposed to happen in some way. You open. Things don't stay the same. We think, okay, now I'll become spiritual, and I'll just be open and spacious and loving and like holding your breath, you know, and nothing will ever change. But that's not how it is. You know, your breath opens and closes, and the your body does with each breath, and your cerebrospinal fluid pumps and bathes your brain, and your heart pumps and it opens and closes. But also your heart and mind in the spiritual sense open and close. So you get open, and you walk down the street, and you're so touched. You see an old woman crossing the street, and it's like your old grandmother, and you just love her, and the fact that she even survived, even if she's, you know, tottering and not all that attractive, but there's some tenderness, you know. And then somebody cuts you off in traffic, you know, and threatens you in some way, and all that alarm goes, and how they could, and then they give you the finger afterward, and you know, you could, you know, get really angry with them, you know, that then you're out on the battlefield. It's weird what we do in cars, what we say and do in cars. We wouldn't do if the person didn't, if there wasn't some metal between us.
That's right.
But all that stuff, very primitive, comes up, and you go, I flunked the test. I'm now a spiritual failure.
Yes.
Right? But there's something even worse that happens, and better, which is because you were in Hawaii for a couple of weeks and you were really open and so forth, you go, oh, no, this isn't really how I want to live. And you, the worst part is that you see it really clearly. You right. feel the pain of it and you go, oh, God, got drunk, yelled at him again, did this. You know, I don't think this is actually the journey I think I want to spend most of my time. And so it fits and starts, and that's fine.
Right, right, right.
It's just fine.
I wanted to ask you, this is a question I've had about Buddhism, it's something I've always wondered and I've never been able to figure it out. There's the temptations. Buddha's about to gain enlightenment, is tempted by Mara, the force of death. I don't need to tell you the story, obviously, but the third thing that happens is that Mara said, please correct me if I say this the wrong way. Mara says to Buddha, why do you deserve to be Buddha? And Buddha takes his finger and touches the ground. Mm. What does that mean?
Actually, the image, and you see it a lot in all those statues of Buddha, which, by the way, there were no Buddha statues for 500 years. He didn't want images of himself. And the very first statues of Buddha, 400 or 500 years after that time, were copies of Greek statues, and Buddha looks like Apollo in them. And the Greeks had all these cool statues, and people said, well, if you can put Apollo, we're going to make a statue of our guy, our team, too, you know.
Wow.
But anyway, in those statues, sometimes you see the Buddha sitting there, that image, and one hand touching the earth. It's called the earth witness mudra. Mudra means a gesture of awakening and so forth. And as the story or the myth goes, because these are all mythological, the Buddha touched the earth and asked the earth to be his witness, to say that he had practiced patience and compassion and forgiveness and dedication and honesty for so long that he deserved to sit on the spot and to awaken, no matter what those clamoring voices of Mara and the demons were. And the earth answered in some way, the goddess of the earth, and said, yes, this is my son, and he has practiced patience and dedication and truthfulness and generosity, and he's a human being who is ready to see clearly and deserves to awaken, as everyone listening to this podcast does, as every human being. So it's a beautiful gesture because it means instead of being in your head and lost and reacting to all that stuff, you touch the earth and you realize, I'm here and I'm supposed to be here. Mm. And the earth is supporting me, as it does, to be alive, to breathe, to drink, to move. And in that support, I too have the capacity to see clearly, to awaken, to see this human incarnation.
Wow.
So that's you, Duncan. You become the Buddha touching the earth. And, you know, with that, your dignity returns.
Right. Touching the earth. Great possible name for your podcast.
Touching the earth. There we go.
Pretty cool, man. This is, well, it's 35 minutes. I don't know how long you want your podcast to last. Mine usually lasts an hour.
I'll go a little bit longer. Okay. We're having a good time. I am, anyway.
Oh, I am. No, this is a mate. This is...
So I want to read you a story, Duncan. And this is from the Jewish mystical tradition, where this great rabbi taught his disciples to memorize and reflect and contemplate and place the holy teachings and the holy words of the teachings on their heart. And one day, one of the students asked the rabbi why he always used the phrase, on your heart. And the master replied, only grace can put the teachings in your heart. Here you recite and learn and contemplate and remember and put them on your heart, hoping that sometime when your heart breaks, they will fall in.
Heartbreak.
And there's something in us about thinking that when we succeed at things, which is a beautiful thing, it's great, you should succeed, that that's the end of the story. But often it's when, whether it's the literal heartbreak in love or when your heart breaks because someone you care about is in trouble or because the earth, you know, what's happening to the earth around you touches you in some way, that vulnerability, if you can bear it, if you can find the courage to let it touch you, that sometimes makes you a realer and more honest and fiercer and at the same time more genuine, more loving person than anything else you could do. And it puts you in the company of humanity everywhere. You're not isolated. You're in it with us.
Yeah,
How's that sound?
You know what it makes me think of? It makes me think of when I've had too much to drink and I want to throw up, and I know I'm going to feel much better if I throw up, but for some reason I fight puking. You know when you're laying in bed.
It's very unpleasant. You don't want to do it.
The room's spinning. You know if you get the poison out of your body, you'll feel 50 times better, but you fight it. You know, when my mom passed away, I had moments of like the most extreme and intense heartbreak I've ever experienced. Sobbing uncontrollably, and I can't get back there. I was able to do it for months, you know, or it would come over me and I couldn't stop it, or it happened at weird times, completely out of the blue. But now it's, I don't know. I can't get that. I don't want it to, in the same way I don't want to vomit when I've had too much tequila. That was so overpowering. I don't know how I could function in the world if my heart was that open. It seems like everything would make me start sobbing like that. You know, anything would.
Yeah, the mosquito landing and you're so touched that you start to weep. Oh, look at that. Yeah.
Maybe that's not with the mosquitoes.
Maybe not the mosquito, but, you know, and that's not us as human beings. We open and close.
Right.
If you can't open sometimes, then that's a real grief. You know, you need to be able to let yourself weep. And you need to let yourself be touched deeply. And then sometimes you kind of hitch up your pants and whatever skirt and go out there and do what you got to do.
Yeah.
And both of those are part of being human. And a lot of this has to do with the ease of being present where you are, not having some idea of how it's supposed to be,
right. But
a kind of sensitivity so that I watch it with the Dalai Lama. He's a really extraordinary exemplar of this, because in Dharamsala, where he lives in northern India, one of his practices is if he's there every morning, he will go out to meet any of the Tibetan refugees who've walked over the mountains, over the highest mountains on earth, to escape torture or prisons or things that are happening to the Tibetan people. And often their dream of all dreams is to get to meet His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So he'll go out and he'll greet them and hold their hand, give them a little scarf as a blessing. And often he hears the worst stories, you know, terrible, terrible stories of what happened. And then later in the day, he'll be doing something else and he'll be laughing because he's got this great sense of humor. I think people go to see the Dalai Lama not just to hear the Tibetan teachings, which are wonderful practices and things. People, all the tens of thousands of people sign up, they want to go hear him laugh. That this beautiful man could carry so much tragedy and still at times also put that down and say, isn't this a mystery? Isn't this amazing? And laugh and delight in the world and not let himself get taken over by one side or the other. It doesn't mean that he can't grieve, because he certainly does, but it means that he's not stuck on one channel, that his heart becomes gracious and fluid, and the qualities of mindfulness and compassion, things that we train in meditation, aren't to become a good meditator, but they're really just to let us be open to this play of life with some graciousness, some wisdom, some ease.
Right.
Something like that.
Stuck on one channel. Yes, I can relate to that. That's where your wheels are just stuck, spinning in the mud. And, you know, this is one of the things I've gotten from your teachings is just this, I'll just tell myself this won't last. Whatever the thing is, it's not going to last. Well, I tell myself that with the bad stuff. With the good stuff, I try to forget that. But definitely that eases a lot of the corollary tension and anxiety that goes along with a negative state. I love that, the idea of becoming fluid. But, you know, how do I start? I stopped meditating. And how do I get back into it again?
It's like getting into the water after a cold winter and the water's too cold and you think you're afraid to go back in.
That's it.
A little at a time. First of all, instead of setting some ambitious goal, you say, for the next few days, I'm going to sit for 3 minutes. Just for 3 minutes, you can't really do it wrong, right? You just sit there.
Right.
And then you tolerate what's there. And if anything, you feel your breath and you say, I could enjoy this. 3 minutes, you might even think, I want to do this a little, or don't. Just stop. 3 minutes. I'm only going to do 3 minutes. You set your little egg timer or whatever, your phone, you know, whatever it is. And you say, let me just feel this breath and feel my own humanity with its 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows, with the ocean of tears and the magnificent beauty of life. And I'm just going to take my seat in it and come back to be present for 3 minutes. That's all. And try that a few days and then see what happens.
Thank you.
A little at a time.
Cool. I'm definitely, thank you. That's the answer, of course. Yeah, because I always want to do, I'm going to do an hour. Today, I'll do an hour.
We turn into a kind of grim duty. Okay, I'm going to go to the gym.
Yes.
You know, and work out, and I'll go to therapy, and I'll get on a diet, and
yes,
I'm going to meditate myself to be a better person.
You just said, that's my inner dialogue all the time, and it never happens.
And the author, Florida Scott Maxwell, she writes, no matter how old a mother is, she looks to her middle-aged children for signs of improvement. And we internalize that stuff, and we're going, okay, Duncan's going to be a better model. Now he's going to be a Buddhist Duncan, really.
With a six-pack.
Yes, exactly. Spare your friends and family. You don't need to become a Buddhist. Thank you. The point is to become a Buddha and not a Buddhist. And to become a Buddha means to have real compassion and mercy and a tender heart, even for the times when you don't have a tender heart.
How do you do that when you don't? I'm sorry.
You just pause. Just the same deal. You know, like, you know, 3 minutes or putting your toes in the cold water, you realize, oh, God, I'm just overwhelmed. I'm angry. I can't forgive. I'm never going to forgive. I hate that person, whatever. And I hate myself for not forgiving. And then you just sit there. You take your 3 minutes. Instead of doing mindfulness, maybe you do 3 minutes of compassion. And you say, all right, let me hold all this whole mess, like other people who are in the same mess, with compassion. And you breathe and you realize whatever it is, even your mom who died. I mean, you mentioned something that's really powerful for you and profound in our life when our parent dies. My mom just died some weeks ago, and she was 91 and ready, and surrounded by a lot of love. And still, it was tender and poignant, and I miss her and all those things. And you take your seat, and you say, let me just hold everything that's here with compassion. This is how it is to be human. It includes forgetting, not hating, forgiving, I'm never going to forgive, feeling bitter, feeling lost, and say, oh, this is what feeling lost is like, and lack of forgiveness is like this, and so forth. Let me hold this whole thing with compassion. Mm. And then the other thing you can do is remember that just at that moment when you're sitting for your 3 minutes feeling that, remember that there's 27 million other people in America whose mothers have died this last year or two. And when they let themselves remember and sit quietly, their heart aches and they're sitting there with their stuff too. And you're all being human together.
Thank you. I knew it. I knew you'd make me cry, Jack Kornfield.
There we go. I charge extra for that.
Wow. Man, I really hope you keep doing this podcast. This is great.
Well, I might need your help, Duncan. We might need to do some more together.
Whatever you need, just okay. Let me know.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good.
Oh, boy, I forgot that I cried at the end of that thing. I'm afraid to go back and listen to what induced that, because then I might not upload this podcast. So forgive me for always getting weepy on this thing. And thank you guys for listening. Thank you, MindPodNetwork.com. Go check out MindPodNetwork.com. Subscribe to their podcast. Give them some support. Help this brand new endeavor blossom and grow. And if you like this podcast, why not subscribe to us on iTunes and give us a nice rating over there. Join the forum located at DuncanTrussell.com. Take your dog to the groomer. Dye your dog with dog-friendly dyes. Make sure you give him a nice haircut. Trim your father's toenails and make sure to rub coconut oil into your bunions. We'll be back. We've got some great podcasts coming up. A bunch of live podcasts with Daniele Bellelli. I've also Chris Ryan, Johnny Pemberton. A podcast with Graham Hancock is coming up, and a podcast with Timothy Showalter from Strand of Oaks is coming up. All of these are in the can, so expect to be machine gunned with podcasts over the next few weeks. Thank you guys so much for listening. I'll see you soon. Hare Krishna.